This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
But it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years
on Bloomberg Radio.
Friday the 14th, you're listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson. Alex Steele has a well-deserved day off today. Remember, it is Martin Luther King Day on Monday as well, so US markets are going to be closed. What a massive week it's been in terms of so many stories that we've been covering. Equity markets all over the place. You've had huge amounts of Fed speak, really hammering home the position that rates are going higher, as a result of which equity markets coming to the end of the week very much under pressure. The Nasdaq over in the United States down by 5.3% so far this year. Today, flat, down only 0.1%. The S&P's off a little bit more. The banks in the States are firm focus. We'll come on to that in just a moment. JP Morgan trading 159.30 down by 8. So a little bit of pressure there. The earnings season was meant to be strong. We've got a cost story that we need to focus on. Here in Europe, the FTSE 100 continues to outperform. So today down by 0.2%. But mining stocks and energy stocks have had a really good week. And as a result of which the FTSE 100 year to date is actually up by 2.15%. The CAC 40 and the DAX are both flat so far year to date, just slightly negative. Today down by around 1%, though. We've seen EDF in particular coming under pressure in France, but generally the energy story front and centre. A number of different angles on this story, and again, we'll come back to it a little bit later on and have a focus on what is happening with the situation in Ukraine. So that's the kind of the pitch we face ourselves with at the moment. We need to talk about the Fed in a little bit more detail. We'll be joined by Mike McKee a little bit later on in the program. But let's focus now on what is happening with the banking story. Banks generally, so far this year, have had a really solid run. The idea is that higher interest rates are going to boost this sector. They are the high beta play on both sides of the Atlantic on this higher rates narrative. Today, though, we started to get the earnings coming through. And while we are focusing what is happening on the revenue side, we are focusing as well on what is happening with the cost side. And that is where the challenge may lie for some of these institutions. JP Morgan certainly flagging that. Let's listen to what the CFO had to say a little bit earlier.
We are in for a couple of years of sub-target returns. Despite this, we are going to continue to invest, and we're not going to let temporary headwinds distract us from critical strategic ambitions.
The CFO of JP Morgan talking to us, talking on the call a little bit earlier on. Talking to us now is the person you want to talk to at Bloomberg as these numbers come out. Bloomberg, Shanali Basak. Shanali, we've had Citi today, we've had Wells today, and we've had JP Morgan, the giant in the sector, all reporting numbers. Walk us through what we've learned.
It's just an incredible day and such a big window into consumer businesses, both in the U.S. and abroad. And what we know is that the consumer is just not rebounding as fast as anyone thought it would, and that other parts that are bright about the consumer are not yielding a lot of profit yet. Because as credit cards start to become popular again, people are using their credit cards, taking out loans, they're also paying down their balances, which means that banks are not necessarily making a lot of interest on the credit card loans they have out. So until that starts to happen, and we will see, and JP Morgan has intended that they would compete very heavily in that card space. In fact, Guy, JP Morgan this quarter has become the biggest credit card issuer in the U.S., surpassing Citigroup, which has held that title for years. And when we look at the cost that will go up, that will require to stay competitive in the space, technology spend, marketing spend will be among some of the biggest costs that JP Morgan will contend with as they move forward to gain more share in the space.
The story on the revenue side is interesting, but the story on costs is also a huge factor here. And Jamie Dimon and the rest of the team really flagging the challenge that lies ahead.
It's so interesting because on one hand, you do have them saying that wage inflation is one of the biggest forms of inflation they're seeing. Some of this is because of attrition that they've been seeing, so competition from all sorts of types of companies, high-frequency market makers, fintech companies, private equity firms. But part of this is also the idea that there are other factors that might go up in the future that will cost the bank more at the end of the day. When it comes to wages, you know, this is a business about that revolves around money. I mean, pay is the number one question at all points in time, pay and retention, especially for J.P. Morgan, which is, in addition to being, the largest consumer bank, it's also the largest and one of the largest investment banks. It has the largest fixed income trading division, and it has the second biggest advisory firm next to Goldman Sachs when it comes to mergers and acquisitions. It's the biggest debt underwriter. And to stay competitive in those spaces, it means that talent is required to win those businesses. These are parts of Wall Street that have not yet been automated away by any means and still requires manpower, and very expensive manpower often, to get the job done.
We've learned in the last hour that Goldman Sachs is going to be paying its top 100% millions of dollars extra, special one-time rewards, basically, to try and keep these staff on board. What do we know about exactly how those payments are going to work?
Well, a couple of things that are interesting. First of all, the payments at Goldman Sachs can be in the tens of millions of dollars for their top performers when it comes to bonuses. And now we're hearing that there's a pool of a few hundred, about 400 or so, employees who will be subject to another award despite its bonus pool already. It makes a lot of sense because if you look at a lot of the highest paying firms on Wall Street, whether they're boutique investment banks, private equity firms, or hedge funds, what's happening at those smaller firms is you are having a lot of money in some of the most high octane, most volatile businesses on Wall Street going to a fewer amount of people. And so this is a real retention play. And what's interesting too, Guy, is that Goldman Sachs has been so profitable, more profitable than they've been in years, that this is a year in which they have that financial flexibility to make these payments possible.
Sarah Blue Raskin is a name that we're going to all hear a lot about over the next few weeks, nominated today by the White House as the Fed's top banking regulator. It's going to be a challenge to get her confirmed by the Senate, but nevertheless, how big a challenge is regulation going to be for this sector?
Well, it'll certainly feel jarring for the banks because in the last several years, in the last 4 years in particular, they have not had strong or very strict regulation compared to the years before that after the financial crisis. Of course, they had certain things to contend with after the financial crisis, but they've really not had too much change as of late. But with Sarah Bloom Raskin, remember, she was there in the wake of 2008, and she did play an integral role as Dodd-Frank was getting off the ground. So as these banks go back into merchant banking, lean more on trading businesses, what kinds of clamps is she going to want to put down? You and I have talked about this before. We finally see the Fed take a harder line when it comes to banks and their hedge fund clients after the Archegos blow up. You know, Sarah Bloom Raskin is somebody who would have a lot of thoughts about something like that and find more ways to regulate the banking system via the tools that the Fed has. And on a global scale, and perhaps the most contentious thing that she may be looking at is climate change and climate financing as it pertains to the banks and any systemic risk that may pertain and how the banks would stress test against it. Republicans are very against the Fed and the SEC getting involved in the arena where they think there should be more congressional authority. But at the same time, you do see the federal regulators and agencies being tossed the ball as Congress has not wanted to deal with it.
Shanala, just very briefly, Citi, a business in transition. We're going to get an update in March. What have we learned today about kind of that huge transition that Frazier is delivering? Just in 30 seconds, if you could.
Yeah, we've learned that they've exited a lot of businesses already and they're doubling down on private wealth. And let's see what that ends up meaning and how they'll compete with some of the biggest in that business at the end of the day.
Yep, exiting a number of businesses. It's going to be interesting to see exactly how that works and what impact it's going to have. Shanala, great work today as ever. Thank you so much for joining us both on Bloomberg Television and here on Bloomberg Radio. Shanala Basak on the U.S. banking season, which continues next week. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. This is The Cable. I'm Guy Johnson. There is an expectation that European equities will outperform this year, certainly versus the United States. We're hearing it from house after house, strategist after strategist. We're certainly seeing a focus on the cyclicality that Europe may offer, but also on the valuation story as well. Earlier, Kriti Gupta and I caught up with Banu Baweja. Banu is UBS's chief strategist. We talked about kind of how Europe is going to feature in the portfolio this year, whether this is a trade or something you want to hang on to.
It certainly is, Guy, for at least the first part of this year. So we do think that rotation towards value is likely to sustain for the next couple of quarters. There should be a pretty decent pickup in growth in Europe. So unlike the U.S., growth in Europe has been roughly on the 1 to early 2s handles, whereas U.S. has been growing around 4 to 5% annualized quarter on quarter. In the second quarter of this year, we expect Europe to grow somewhere between 7 to 8%, so really a big catch-up. And that should mean that the earnings seasons for the next couple of quarters should go quite well. And so that's what we expect. We expect risk to do reasonably well, even as liquidity tightens, growth holds up, and value and Europe outperform. But in the second half of this year, we think growth goes back towards trend. And at that time, the liquidity growth mix certainly worsens. So this rotation for us is a trade. It's not an investment. And the rotation also to Europe, therefore, is a trade, not an investment. I don't think we'd like to hold on to an overweight position on Europe through the course of this year. I think we go back towards growth and back towards the U.S. in the second half of this year. So it really is a case of playing this tactically and the rotation also being a short-term one.
A trade, not an investment. That's fascinating at a time when a lot of people are saying that those flows are going to go to Europe and stay there. Talk to us a little bit about the currency exposure. We're already seeing flows come out of the dollar in particular. Are they going to the euro? Are they going to European assets? What's your take?
I think they will, because what Europe or what euro dollar really enjoys is global reflation, and we are likely to see global reflation in the coming two quarters. Certainly as supply bottlenecks ease, Europe's own growth is likely to pick up substantially. Just as a statistical fact, I think it's worth mentioning that if you look at Germany's industrial production relative to something like Italy, which is, you know, not as high tech as German industrial production, as semiconductor shortages have hit German and French industrial production much more, the gap between German and Italian industrial production just over the last 12 to 18 months has been about 16%. So you do expect a big catch-up in Northern Europe in terms of production, in terms of exports, in terms of new orders, yep. And that should mean that the euro is also reasonably well bid. Asia's trade balance with Europe has soared, so Europe's deficit has really increased. And I think as auto exports begin again, I think that should help, and Europe's underperformance relative to Asia should correct over the next 6 months. Again, this is not a long-term call.
Banu, we've got an energy crisis in Europe. You've got the situation around Ukraine. You've got EDF having to take offline some of their nuclear power plants for a bit longer than anticipated. German Q3 power prices up 25% today. There are massive moves, massive volatility in the energy complex here in Europe right now. How big a headwind is that going to be, both near-term and medium-term?
I think that is a headwind. There's no doubt about that, that, you know, consumer stocks can be impacted, certainly consumer discretionary. You saw that, by the way, not just in Europe, where this is a bigger problem. Even in the U.S., if you look at University of Michigan sentiment index that was released today, it is telling you that people's willingness to buy durable goods is actually not very strong. So I think this will be a headwind for some parts of the market, for the consumer. But thankfully, front-month prices for energy have begun to come off, although not 12-month prices. And we do think of this as a short-term headwind.
Banu Baweja talking to Kriti Gupta and I a little bit earlier on, talking about that energy crisis. And one of the factors that obviously needs to be borne in mind is what is happening in Ukraine right now. We've had talks this week between Russia and the United States, Russia and various European bodies, including NATO. The Russians describing those as a dead end today. Where do we go next? There's a cyber attack that has been underway today in Ukraine. Are we in the position where we are basically talking about a prelude to war? Rosalind Matheson joining us next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. I want to turn now to what is happening with the Ukraine. Ukraine is at the center of what could be a multifaceted challenge for Europe. What is a multifaceted challenge? We've had talks this week between the United States and Russia, between NATO and Russia, between the European group more broadly and Russia. The Russians describing those talks as a dead end. We've also had today the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, basically saying that, that Europe and the West need to get on with providing Russia with guarantees about some of the demands that have been made. You've had a cyber attack taking place in Ukraine today. You've got the United States basically talking about the idea that Russia is fabricating potential cause belli, basically reasons to go to war in Ukraine for an invasion. Where are we? The clock is ticking clearly. The fear is that Russia will put boots on the ground, more boots on the ground, you could argue. Ros Matheson joins us now, Bloomberg's Ros Matheson, to give us an update. Ros, this was meant to be the week in which we made breakthroughs. We don't seem to be making them. The Russians seem reasonably intransigent in terms of the demands that are being made and are basically saying that talks are at an end. What happens next?
Well, that was the difficulty, is these talks were always going to struggle to find a way through because they're starting from positions that they can't meet each other on. The Russian president wants security guarantees that US and NATO say they just simply cannot give. So where is the ground in the middle that they can concede to each other to avoid a war? So the problem is that they've come out of these talks, if anything, even more in each other, in different corners to each other, and no way forward and no pathway for talks. And so you're seeing the rhetoric really hardening, both from the Russian side and also the US now, as you were saying, warning of possible false flag operations by Russia to try and kick off a war with Ukraine, or a pretext at least to go in. So certainly you would say that the atmosphere is extremely tense. The Russian president says he still does not want a war in Ukraine. He's still considering his options. And even though he has the military advantage there, there are disadvantages to him kicking off a war with Ukraine. Certainly the threat of major economic sanctions from Europe and the US for starters. So we may be some time away from an absolute conflict, but certainly this week has done nothing to diminish the possibility that it might come.
Some may argue that war has already started. Some may argue it started quite some time ago. And I appreciate what we've seen today in Ukraine is not a kinetic war, but it is a virtual war. We've got a cyber attack that has taken place. Has the conflict already started?
Well, someone could argue that it has, and certainly the concern from the exclusive reporting we put out a short time ago from Europe is the fear that it doesn't have to actually even culminate in a military invasion. It could be a variety of things, as you said, cyber attacks both on Europe and on Ukraine, destabilization efforts inside Ukraine. Do you use disinformation and other things to try and engineer a coup in Ukraine against the president? He's a gentleman that the Russians simply despise and want out of there. Do you actually need to have a proper invasion? Can you use smaller guerrilla groups to go in and mess about? So there's the possibility of lots of things that really are achieving his goals without the sort of full military attack that would bring those repercussions. And that's certainly what the Europeans are growing increasingly concerned about.
Do we know what Putin's objective is?
No one knows what Putin's objective is. In fact, the only person who knows that is in his head right now. It's clear from those members of his ministry who were out this week speaking, the foreign minister, the deputy foreign minister, and so on, that they've got very limited boundaries on what they can discuss and negotiate. They've got three things they can say about what they want from NATO, and that's about it. And they've made it clear that they're actually not there negotiating on behalf of Vladimir Putin. They're just simply there to present his demands. So it's still very unclear, and the Americans are saying the same, the Europeans are saying the same. Exactly what he intends at this point, no one really knows.
In terms of the impact that we could feel here in Europe, we've seen energy prices rising sharply today. The concern is that we could see significantly more volatility. If we were to see an invasion of Ukraine, would gas flow continue, or would that be part of the conflict as well?
It's certainly a significant concern because Russia has leverage there in terms of the reliance of Europe on Russian gas supplies. And we've seen Russia use that as a lever before. They'll pause gas supply, they'll cut it off for a bit and so on, or they'll just sort of lessen the amount of gas that's coming in. And certainly there's a risk, and that's why the market is concerned, that if you penalise Russia with stringent sanctions, perhaps on the financial sector, what he will do is turn around and retaliate by cutting off gas to Europe. And certainly that's underpinning the escalation that we're seeing in prices.
So to what extent are Europe and the United States on the same page then?
Well, that's been a rising concern also, is that you are seeing some differences, particularly within Europe, about how strongly to retaliate in the event of a conflict. There's a whole suite of potential sanctions on the table for discussion between Europe and the US. The US is wanting to go very hard in terms of penalties. In Europe, they're much more anxious about economic impact on their own economies, including on gas, for one thing. But also, if you cut Russia out of the global financial payment system, you're also going to hurt other economies alongside that and other companies. And so the concern in Europe is about those really nuclear options when it comes to sanctions, whereas the US wants to go much, much harder.
To what extent is the weather going to play a part in this? Not only in terms of the operational story on the ground, it is cold, therefore difficult to fight, but also presumably the leverage around the gas story will dissipate once we start to get into the warmer weather a little later on in the year.
Well, that's right, because the muddy terrain does make it harder for a quick invasion through Ukraine. Like, it makes it harder because of the tanks that are involved and they need frozen ground to move on tracks. And so it does make it more complicated for a large-scale, rapid invasion of Ukraine. That said, he would probably start with aerial bombardments and also artillery. So it's not out of the bounds that he could still consider an invasion once we get past, say, the end of February, although the main window seems to be between now and the end of February. But certainly after that, even then, you can't rule an invasion out.
Ross, thank you very much indeed for the update, a story we all need to pay significant attention to. Thank you very much indeed. Bloomberg's Ross Matheson. This is The Cable. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome back. You are listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson. Alex Steele has a well-deserved day off today. Let me just update you on where we are with markets around the world. Start with equities. FTSE 100 finishing fairly flat today, down by 0.2%. Year to date, it's up by around 2%, though. A big outperformer. Today, the CAC down 0.8%. The DAX down by 0.9%. They're both flat on the year. Stateside, the NASDAQ now negative, down by 0.1%, but it's off by 5.5% year-to-date. The S&P down by 0.4%, down by 2.7% year-to-date. Banks today adding significant weight to the downside. It's interesting that tech is outperforming. The real narrative around the tech sector has been about the real pivot we've seen from the Fed. Huge pivot. And this week we've had a lot of noise around the Fed. It has been frenetic in terms of the amount of Fed speak that we have had, as John Farrow would say. And we've also had today some significant news as well. Joe Biden, the US president, announcing some Fed picks, which we've been waiting for. Sarah Bloom-Braskin to be the Federal Reserve's top banking regulator. We've got economists Lisa Cook and Philip Jefferson both being selected to be governors. They've been nominated. Remember, obviously, they have to be confirmed by the Senate. Raskin could face really quite a big challenge in that process. Jamie Dimon today, the CEO of JP Morgan, warning that the Fed could hike 7 times and not be sweet and gentle when it comes to its management of the US economy. John Williams from the New York Fed has been talking today. We've also seen Daly from all the way out in California making some comments as well, kind of talking about the narrative about how many rate hikes we're going to see and what the balance sheet roll-off could ultimately end up looking like. This is a huge pivot for the Fed, a huge pivot that the market has got to adjust to. So we're getting quite a lot of volatility, both in the stock market and in the bond market as well. Let's try and pull it all together. Let's try and make sense of it all. There is but one person to ask when you need to make sense of what is happening at the Fed, and that is not Jay Powell. It is Bloomberg's Mike McKee, and he joins us in New York. Mike, we come through to the end of the week. It has been frenetic.
It's
just kind of walk me through the pace of change that we're going through here.
Well, it's kind of interesting because this isn't a surprise.
No, it's not. But it
cut
feels
rates
brutal.
To zero, and you knew they had to go back up again. So the markets have adjusted reasonably well because it's not like the Fed is all of a sudden telling them something they didn't know was coming. Now it's a question of trying to figure out timing and what it means for the overall economy and for the bond market especially. The traders have to figure out what the other traders are going to be doing. So there's some confusion and volatility, as you say. But for the Fed, it's not a huge shift. It's just one that was coming and we didn't know exactly when.
Okay, that's fine. I appreciate what you're saying in terms of the rate adjustment. I think it probably has shifted a little bit. We've gone from kind of 3 to 4. That's kind of current pricing this year, and then even more to come next year. You've also then got the factor of the balance sheet roll-off and QT to factor in. And I think that probably is where maybe people have been a little bit more surprised in terms of the pivot. John Williams has been talking today from the New York Fed, talking about the low level of real yields 5 to 10 years out being striking. He's talking about it being hard to be precise in terms of the balance sheet normalization, but he does expect long rates to rise as that balance sheet is normalized. And it looks as if, while they are saying that the primary tool will remain rates, that they are going to try and maybe manage the curve in terms of using that balance sheet story. That's the bit that I'm still trying to struggle with and still trying to understand here in terms of how the Fed is thinking about not only kind of raising rates, but also kind of marrying that up with balance sheet reduction and trying to generate this less flat curve maybe going forward from there.
Well, most of what the Fed owns is in short maturity bonds. So it notes if they start not replacing those, they can run off fairly quickly.
Yep.
And so you'll have less pressure on the short end, and maybe that helps steepen the curve a little bit. But the Fed is going to primarily do interest rates. They probably will do 2, maybe 3 moves before they start letting the balance sheet run off. They're not exactly sure of the total impact. It's hard to get a quantitative model of exactly when they start to run off what that's going to do to interest rates. It's easier with the interest rate, the Fed funds movement. So that'll be complementary, but it won't be the main way they're going to try to control the borrowing rates in the United States.
Jamie Dimon's talking about potentially 7. The market's pricing in maybe even more than that in terms of rate hikes that we could see. The question that I can't get to yet is, where is the terminal rate? You talk to a lot of people. What are they thinking in terms of how ultimately high rates will have to go in order to choke off the inflation that so many Fed officials are concerned about?
It depends on who you talk to. The Fed didn't get the Fed has had 2.5% as its terminal rate for a very long time. They couldn't even get to that after the Great Financial Crisis. They started normalizing and got to about 1.5, and had to stop. So there is a big group of people who think that the Fed won't get to 2.5 because we're going to run out of the extra money that's been fueling this excess demand here, and the supply chains will normalize and inventories will normalize, and so economic growth will slow down. There are others who say that inflation has gotten so entrenched at this point and is so high at this point, the Fed's going to have to go well above 2.5%. To be able to control inflation. There are people in the Bill Dudley in the 3 to 4% category. So it's kind of hard to know at this point who's going to be right.
We've also seen staffing changes or potential staffing changes at the Fed. We know that Rich Clarid is going to be stepping down a little bit earlier. We've now got the president, Joe Biden, picking Sarah Bloom Raskin to be the Federal Reserve's top banking regulator. We've also got the economist Lisa Cook and Philip Jefferson stepping up potentially to be governors. How easy is the confirmation process going to be?
For Cook and Jefferson, it's not going to be all that difficult. They're both very well-respected economists. Jefferson endorsed by a number of Republicans already. And Cook is just so much a part of the Fed and the work she's done that they shouldn't have a problem. Raskin will be problematic, but probably get confirmed. She's written a lot on climate change, things that the Republicans don't like because they think she will drive the Fed into policymaking over climate change. people who know her say she wouldn't. But there'll be some tough questions about that and about bank regulation and how far she's going to go. She's not going to be Randy Quarles, but Raj Cohen of Sullivan and Cromwell telling us just a short time ago that she's going to be more like Randy Quarles than people think in that she's a pragmatist.
The Fed goes into a quiet period tonight ahead of the next meeting. What are we going to learn at that next meeting?
They'll probably lay out a roadmap for us in terms of what they're going to do with interest rates. They won't say on this date, and this date. But they'll say something like it is now time to start normalizing interest rates. And we could see movement in the next couple of meetings, which will basically be a signal that in March it's coming. We probably won't learn anything about the balance sheet in the statement unless they decide something different than the way they've been hinting. But the minutes will give us more information about what they are planning. I have a question for you, Guy.
Yeah.
How come Alex is off today, but it's your birthday?
It is confusing, isn't it? Yeah. I'm not entirely sure how we ended up in this situation. I'm going to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Happy birthday.
I think if you knew the details of why she was off today, I think it might become a little bit clearer. I don't think she's having a very good time. Anyway, I hope she's okay. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome back. You are listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. It has been an incredible start to the year. It has been brutal. We have figured out a lot more about our understanding about where the Fed is going. We have seen some fairly significant moves when it comes to the tech sector. Not all that surprising, though, in many respects. The moves have been significant, but not big. The market seems to be coping with the Fed pivot remarkably comfortably. We've got an energy crisis that is taking place in Europe. The data are certainly pointing to maybe inflation being stickier than certainly many people thought that it would be. So what does this all mean in terms of market positioning and where we go from here? We've got to fold in the dollar as well to that story. There is but one person to ask, and that is Bloomberg's Cameron Cries, who joins us on the line. Cameron, I haven't talked to you yet. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Guy.
How's it going?
Pretty well, actually. It's an interesting start to the year, which in the job that we're in these days is all you can ask for.
Yep.
West Ham riding high on the table. my favorite American football team somehow snuck into the playoffs. So it's all coming up roses for me. But then again, I don't own super speculative, unprofitable companies in my personal account. So I haven't had any bombs go off in my personal finances. So I can rest a little easier maybe than some people.
Do you think there have been some bombs that have gone off so far? And as you say, it is more at the non-profitable end of the tech spectrum. But the Nasdaq's down circa 5% year to date. But we've had a massive pivot in Fed thinking. I'm quite surprised thus far at how calmly everybody seems to be taking things. Like Jamie Dimon's talking about 7 or even more rate hikes. We're talking about quantitative tightening. We're talking about balance sheet roll-off. The Fed put has been there and supported these markets for a really long time. We've had ample liquidity, which has driven some incredible moves. I appreciate what you say about kind of speculative tech, but speculative tech feels like the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, I would concur with that. I think there's a couple of things at work here which are interrelated. One of which is, despite all the Sturm und Drang about inflation and what have you, I think most people kind of really expect it to come back down and be pretty well behaved before too long. And you can see that in, yes, we've had a sell-off in fixed income, but come on. I mean, these yields are still absurdly low.
Amazingly.
So if there is this embedded belief, whether conscious or subconscious, that inflation is going to play ball with the happy-clappy outcome and that the Fed won't have to really put its foot down, then I guess you can make the excuse that yeah, a little bit of a correction or a little dip or blip or whatever you want to call it is maybe justified while the Fed talks a big game. But at the end of the day, we know that that they're going to touch us with the velvet glove rather than the iron fist.
Jamie Dimon's not so convinced.
Because that's what they always do. Well, in fairness, Jamie Dimon in the last cycle was talking about 10-year yields of 4%. So,
yep.
He gets paid to run J.P. Morgan, not to make forecasts. Right?
No.
That being said, you know, I think there's certainly reason to believe that the market has just been trained to believe that everything will be okay and that things will work out in the end. And, you know, if I want to be cynical, I'd say that the last decade or last dozen years after the GFC, natural selection kind of drove the people that would normally be all over this out of the market.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of beaten up bears. We'll talk more about them in a moment. I want to come back to that subject. Cameron, stick around. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome back. It is 5:48 in the City of London. I want to get back to our conversation that we were having before the break with Bloomberg's Cameron Cries. Cameron talking about the kind of the changing nature of how this market's psychology works. Cameron, many of the bears, many of the of those that believe that ultimately this amount of liquidity will ultimately end in tears have left the market, as you suggest. My question to you is, what is it going to take to convince people that 4, 6, 8, whatever it takes, rate hikes is actually going to have a meaningful impact?
Well, you mean on financial assets?
On financial assets.
Well, I think the obvious transmission mechanism will be the economy slowing. I mean, because ultimately, why are they hiking rates? They're hiking rates because inflation's too high. The only impact that rate hikes and withdrawing liquidity have on inflation is reducing demand. The reason that inflation has been so high has been twofold. One is that aggregate supply is contracted because of supply chain disruptions and because of labor shortages on the one hand, but also demand has been super strong. I mean, we have a terrible retail sales figure today, much worse than the consensus, but we're still... Retail sales are still up 17% year on year. I mean, that's cloud cuckoo land, right? I mean, if aggregate supply is down and demand is up 17% year on year, is there any wonder that inflation is high?
Not at all. But the idea is that the Fed can thread the needle here, that it can bring demand down to the point at which it matches supply, and the idea is the supply side of the economy is going to be improving.
Well, I'm going to use an analogy here. Do you by any chance play Fantasy Premier League?
Occasionally, yes. My son does.
Okay. So inflation to the real economy is like COVID to Fantasy Premier League, in the sense that it makes it very, very difficult to plan ahead. You might see a fixture list and say, okay, well, Leicester's got two games this week, so I'm going to buy a bunch of Leicester players, and I'll make James Maddison, you know, Leicester midfielder, my captain. Great. So you do that, and then you wake up the next day, and, one of Leicester's fixtures has been canceled. The North London Derby.
At short notice, as you say.
That might be called off. So you've made these decisions, but then circumstances change for reasons kind of outside of your control. Your visibility is almost nil. And I think that's the sort of impact that inflation has on the real economy. And the idea that the Fed can fine-tune things with relatively blunt instruments is the triumph of hope over expectation, shall we say, because we know that monetary policy works with a lag. So by the time it has an impact that's evident via inflation, it could well be the case that demand is already on a trajectory, a downward trajectory, that's going to be difficult to stop.
What the dollar is signaling right now? Because there is a line of argument that says the dollar is coming down. Actually, I take a different view. I think it's just a flow story into the rest of the world. But there is a line of argument that says the dollar is basically signaling, and the flat curve is signaling, that the Fed is going to make a policy mistake.
Well, I think the dollar is selling off because we started the year with everyone bullish and everyone long.
I agree. It's positioning. Yep.
And so, A, there's been a reversal of that, and B, if U.S. stock market's going down more than others and U.S. bond market's going down more than others and you're a foreigner who owns this stuff, what are you going to do? You're going to sell it and bring the money back home. bond investments tend to be currency hedged. Equity investments are not currency hedged. So all else being equal, if equity flow goes out of the U.S. and to the rest of the world, that's dollar selling and rest of the world's currency buying. So I think you combine those two issues, that explains a lot of what we've seen. Vis-a-vis the dollar, and also historically, the dollar gets caned the first 6 months of a Fed rate hike cycle. Last four full cycles, the dollar has been hit pretty hard.
We haven't even started the cycle yet, though.
But I think one of the issues here is that the Fed has basically come out, beating the drum for accelerating it. So everyone expects them to hike in March now, whereas, a month ago, you're thinking was May or June. And I'm not the only one with a spreadsheet, and I'm not the only one with a memory that knows that the dollar tends to sell off once they start hiking.
The starting point
is everyone is long, then it kind of makes sense to make an adjustment.
The U.S. rates have moved a bit. I think kind of relative to kind of the reality going on around them, they've moved very little. One of the things that and you just talked about it, one of the things that has happened is money has poured into the United States as a result of super low rates that we've seen here in Europe. If we were to see the Bund go positive, if we were to see, I don't know, OATs go positive, I think that's probably a bit further away, but maybe core Europe go positive, how big an impact would that have over in the United States in terms of pushing US rates significantly higher?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's two dynamics at work here. One is if European rates go up, then the marginal demand for U.S. Treasuries at any given yield level will be lower, right, because the opportunity cost is smaller. But the other kind of underappreciated aspect of this is as the U.S. curve flattens, I'm not talking 2s-10s or 5s-30s, I'm talking sort of 3-month 10-year, then the cost of hedging the currency goes up. If you're a European investor, you want to buy treasury and hedge it back into euros, essentially you're selling dollars funding that at the short-term dollar rate, which is okay if the short-term dollar rate is 20 basis points. But what if it's 75 basis points or 100 basis points?
Yep.
And that becomes a lot more costly. So the shape of the U.S., say, 3-month 10-year curve, as that flattens, then all else being equal, those treasury investments are going to be a lot less, on our currency hedge basis, are going to be a lot less attractive to Japanese investors,
yep,
to European investors, and thus the bid for treasuries will ebb from overseas, and that could exert also some upward pressure on treasury.
Cameron, have a great weekend. Thank you very much indeed for the time. Enjoy
My
the Leafs game.
You too.
This is Bloomberg.